Welcome back to Cargumentative, where men with poor punctuality blame the traffic for being late. Well, guys, we're going to be talking about cars and all things car culture like we do every week. I'm Thomas Faulkner, and it's good to have back.
I'm Mark Paluta. You can find me at Palutsky on Instagram.
I'm Mike Salomon. You can find me at MH Salomon on Instagram.
I'm Nadav. Thanks for having us back.
It's only a pleasure. Thanks for coming back. You know, a lot of people never come back, but you guys are always here, and it's, you know,
maybe a few minutes late, but we made it.
Well, maybe half an hour, but that's, you know, who's going to split hairs? I'm not. So, guys, big news. We all love Porsches.
Yeah,
right?
We do.
We really do.
We all like Porsche 911s.
We really do.
And so we are all very excited about the new Porsche 911, which is called the Porsche 992.
Yeah.
Came out at the LA Motor Show last week, caused a sensation. And I remember we were talking about it before on the show, and some of us were saying,
we're not too sure
how it's going to look. But actually, in real life, with all the camouflage off and the sticky bits that they put on these cars on prototypes, it looks really good.
Yeah, so initially I thought, I didn't think it was so great. Because, yeah, like you said, we had seen camouflage pictures and we tried to kind of figure out how we thought it would look. But in real life, in the right color, fantastic.
I think in any color
really,
it looks good.
Absolutely.
What do you think?
No, absolutely. And I think, I mean, if we go back and work out, this is Generation 8. First one came out in 1963. I mean, we've gone through a whole lot of generations of air-cooled. Finally, in 1998, went over to water cooling, and now, you know, this is the water cooling is the cars have really come into their own. The cool thing for me on the new one is that they've got a lot of design cues that hark back to the original cars. So it seems, and I have obviously got to see it in the flesh, but it seems like they've raised the pods behind the headlights to give it more of the classic 911 frontal view, and I'd love to see it out the front window. Also on the bonnet, it's got a couple of creases, and if you go and look at an early 911, you can see it. It was functional in the early ones because it was there as a vent to let air into the cabin. But it just, to me, it's phenomenally well-proportioned.
Nadav, the anorak, you probably got your Porsche 911 book out and immediately did a quick dissection of each generation.
Ah, yes, of course. I mean, the rear haunches are very reminiscent of the 997 series.
Absolutely.
Wide bodies. But no, just jokes aside, I think we've all seen it now. We've had a couple of days to get used to the design. And I think as a whole, it's a good-looking car. Mm. I mean, it's nicely proportioned. I think what we're going to struggle with when it actually comes to South Africa and we see it in the metal is its actual size. Everything's
agreed.
In proportion, but I'm very, very worried about how big this two-seater sports car is actually going to be.
Well, they've been getting bigger with every generation.
From the start, there is no narrow body version.
It only comes
in the wide body, so its standard width is the same as the current Carrera S. And as you said, the rear haunches have a lot of shape to them. To me, it looks a lot like the 930 that I've got and when showing it in the same silver. I don't know. To me, it just really, really looks great.
Well, you made an interesting comment today on a group we're on where there was a rear view of it and another beautiful Porsche, classic Porsche. And that was the
959.
Yeah. And I actually couldn't believe the similarities.
Yeah.
It did. It definitely looks, from a full-on rear view, it looks like, you know, you can see something there, some lineage.
Well, funnily enough, the one thing that we've all remarked is that the raisable rear spoiler, which has been part of the 911 since the 964, and that was in 1989 that it came out, that comes up at speed to try and reduce a bit of lift at the back. The spoiler on this goes all the way across the car, and it's very ungainly looking when it's up. It really seems to spoil the look. So I'm hopeful that they will do a 959 wing that is static, that goes the full length of the car. That'll be enough for me.
Talking about 959s, what's amazing about this new 992 is the performance. I mean, the base spec model that they've just bought out. So that's going to be a 992S
There's no normal Carrera. So it's a 992 Carrera S. That thing, standard, does 0 to 100 in like 3.7 seconds, which is quicker than a 959, and has a top speed of 308. I mean, you're getting incredible performance.
And if I'm not mistaken, it has the same power as a 959. 450 horsepower?
I don't know horsepower because I live in South Africa, but it's 331 kilowatts.
Yeah, so it's about the same as a 959. I mean, that's incredible.
It is.
Because that
is
was
incredible.
Like the pinnacle of sports cars at the time.
But even comparing it, I mean, to past GT cars, past GT3s and stuff like that, I mean, you're getting a car that is seriously
quicker. It's got more power than my GT3.
Yeah. I mean, it's impressive.
Significantly more.
I mean, 50 more.
One thing we haven't talked about is pricing. These are a lot more expensive. Nadav, you were showing me pics of pricing.
I had a think back to when the pre-facelift of the previous generation, which was the 991, came out, which was in 2012. I remember it clearly, and I remember thinking that, sure, this is sort of the first Porsche that sort of the base model has broken through the million rand mark, and it was about 1.15 million rand for the base model 991 Mark 1. And the base price for this 992 Mark 1 is somewhere north of 1.7 million.
Yeah,
so that's 700,000 rand increase in the base model price in
under seven years.
Yeah. And that's 100,000 rand year on year. That's all inflation.
Well, the thing about it is that the rand isn't that much weaker than what it was back then. So
it's all inflation.
Although it had done its run all the way to 17 and then came back a bit. But I think the point is that at 1.7 million rand, you know the way that the Porsches work. As soon as you start specking that thing, even with a tiny little thing, you'll go over 2 million rand before you've changed the color.
Yeah. Do you think the pricing thing might see them bring in a base Carrera?
They're going to bring in another T.
Yeah.
So T has always kind of been – it's weird because in the 991.2, the T slotted between the Carrera and the Carrera S, whereas historically, correct me if I'm wrong, the T was base. Yeah, the T, the E, and then the S.
Yes, yeah. Right.
So
like Tess. That's the way you remember it.
Yeah, like that. Yeah, exactly.
Top tip.
Or set backwards.
Thank you, Thomas.
Sure. So, yeah, I think they'll continue with the T because they really sold them well in this last 991.2 range. So maybe they continue that.
Did they sell them well? I mean, there are a whole lot on the market at the moment that seem to be unsold.
Used or from Porsche?
From Porsche.
I can't comment. I know that they were all 911's always been popular. Every generation has outdone expectation, I think, and I'm sure the 992 will continue to be so, even at its quite substantial starting price now. I think we are expecting, I think officially we're expecting a Carrera at some point underneath the Carrera S.
So what do we compare it to in the market?
Well, I mean, looking at the performance spec, you can compare it to stuff that is still more expensive than you know, the price tag that comes attached to this car.
What, a Mercedes GT, AMG GT?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Martin Vantage.
But, once you're going to the Vantage, you're talking about double that price.
Exactly. Yeah. So Porsche is still relatively cheap.
Always good value. It always has been a good value, and perhaps the market's just moved on. The price markers have moved on with it.
And I guess also, you know, they've got the Caymans now as well. So if you do want something a bit cheaper with the Porsche badge on, there's always the Cayman to fall back on.
Yeah.
We're going to be talking about power later in the show, but I mean, the reality of it is that the extra power is probably superfluous. But when you look at what probably is the model to go for is the 991.2, because they're probably going to be quite unloved. You're going to have a lot of people queuing up for this thing, and I suspect there might be some heavy depreciation on that coming up right now.
Well, we'll see. New 992 coming out to South Africa next year. Nadav, one more question.
So just to say that if you guys want to have a look to our audience, have a look online at the 992 online configurator. Lots of fun. Hours of fun.
Your boss will
choose your colors. Your boss will love you. Choose your colors, choose your wheels, and it really is a good looking car.
Green with gold wheels.
Yes.
Of course.
Yeah, absolutely. Beautiful.
Very cool. Well, looking forward to seeing that when it comes to South Africa in the middle of 2019. Guys, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be speaking to a special South African motor racing icon.
Welcome back to Cargumentative, and in this segment of the show, we've got a very special and exclusive interview with a leather wrap warrior of South African motorcycling, Mr. Brad Binder. How are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. How are you guys doing?
Good, yeah, good. Excellent, man.
Fantastic.
Nice to be here with you.
It is. Thanks for taking the time out and being here with us.
Yeah, proper South African rock star.
Exactly. Totally.
Yeah, absolutely. Tom, you seriously have outdone yourself.
Well, you know, it's kind of contacts, you know. Yeah. It's all about who you know.
So I think Mike's going to focus on a couple of lifestyle-orientated questions, where I'm going to maybe ask you a couple of technical questions. Maybe I should start.
Yeah.
So I wanted to find out from you, testing the new Triumph, have you tested it?
Yeah. Basically, so far I've done, we did 3 days of testing in Heret. Okay. Unfortunately, only like just over one and, well, not even one of them. Actually, about half a day was dry, the rest was pouring a rain.
Oh, is it?
So it was difficult. We never really got too many laps in, but in general the new bike is really cool. I'm really enjoying the new Triumph engine, the 765.
I've heard that
Has Triumph never been in MotoGP?
GP, I don't think they have. Maybe back in the day. I hear that the new motor compared to the Honda it replaces has a lot more torque, mid-range and low range, so coming out of corners something different. I don't know if you felt that.
Is
it very different?
It's quite different. The thing is, like on the four cylinder, it only starts to you really feel the power at really high RPM. Yeah. And you have to keep the thing revving, whereas this three cylinder, I find in a lot of places you use like a gear higher, you know. Okay. Just to, you kind of use that torque to get out the corner, and it's a lot. It's really strange to ride because you're so used to like the bike spinning more as the RPM goes up, This thing you kind of like get that thing lit and then it just kind of comes back to you because not much power on top.
So now, okay, so that's going to play a big part in tire management. I think next year, the guys that get tires right are going to be the guys that succeed, I suppose. Because, I mean, I suppose getting on the power earlier mid-corner is going to start to chow the outside of the tire. So the guy that can deal with that, the guy that can manage that, is going to be the guy that makes the tire last the race.
Yeah, at the moment they're actually busy making a wider tire for us, 200 profile tire. So we're going to have a little bit more probably endurance and grip, just to deal with the little bit extra power we have.
Okay, that's cool.
In general, we've got so much electronics in this new bike. Like, I haven't even started to play with the stuff. Like,
oh really?
Like, we have torque maps, because now the new throttles fly by wire. That you can set up the bike so you flat out, you think you flat out, but actually you're like 80% throttle.
Is it?
It's really confusing.
So I remember when you won the championship and we interviewed you last, you spoke about how the jump from Moto 3 to Moto 2, the bikes almost became more agricultural. Like you said, the Moto 3 bike was like a full-on prototype. It's like everything so bespoke on that. Then jumping to Moto 2, using an off-the-shelf kind of Honda motor, you find that the Triumph is a bigger jump tech-wise. Like you're saying, there's fly-by-wire, a throttle-by-wire, there's a lot of torque settings. Is it a lot more technical?
It's completely different. Like, it's literally, my team kept telling me, it's like the Moto 2, the old Honda Moto 2 bike is like having a Game Boy, and now they've got a PS4 to play with.
Oh, really?
So, like, it's hectic. Like, there's really so many different parameters to work in. It's crazy.
Okay, that's cool. It's interesting. It's going to make for some exciting riding next year, I think
so too.
Yeah, lekker.
So you're obviously the 2017 Moto 3 world champion. 2017, you said you were going to go to Moto 2. I remember at Rim and Rubber that evening, you said if you could get one podium in two seasons, that you'd be happy with that. You've already had 3 wins in the Moto 2 class.
Brilliant.
You're now, obviously, because of your competitive nature, thinking about possibilities of winning Moto 2 championships. Question is, moving into a bike now that's essentially a brand new thing, no one's seen it, What are your feelings around having to go and be part of the development process for the next phase of the bike? Are you concerned that you're going to have to now ride out that period while they're developing it, when at the back of your mind you're thinking to yourself, shit, I probably could have been winning this championship?
That's a good question, actually.
Yes.
That's a tough one, tricky, Brad. Eh? Why are you asking all the hard questions,
Mark? I mean, I think it's a bold move. I mean, but, you know, and it's sort of, to me, it feels a little bit like when Schumacher went
in
1996. He made the decision to move over to Ferrari. Yeah. He had the car, the F310, which is a beautiful thing, but wasn't really great. And it took him, he was part and parcel of the development of the car that became the F310B and then the F300, and then eventually won 5 world championships. Yeah. I mean, I think it's an interesting prospect, but what's your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say, really, but I feel like where I am at the moment is quite good. I have amazing people around me and an insane crew. Me and KTM have never entered anything not wanting to win.
Yeah.
So if you look at it in that way, maybe at the moment things are a bit tough and it's been difficult for them, but like, I have a feeling that it's just going to start to click away from here, and it can only get better.
Well, KTM, didn't they? They won the championship. They won the Constructors' Champion.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they're doing flipping well.
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I would say you.
Yeah.
My teammates and I together, we...
Him and the Porra.
...got the most points. Me and my Porra teammates.
Brad, who do you think your main rivals are going to be in the 2019 season?
Who's moving out?
Basically, the two guys that finished in front of me, Miguel Oliveira and Bagnaia, Pecco Bagnaia, they gone to MotoGP. You know, there's going to be a lot of guys next year. I think Lorenzo Baldessari will be strong. Luca Marini, Rossi's brother.
Mm-hmm. Is he good? Is he really good? Is he talented?
You know, it's actually been in Moto2 a long time, but some things clicked this year. Like, he's... He never used to be really that quick, and now all of a sudden he's...
I saw the last couple of races, he's doing well.
He's really doing well.
Got a podium in the last race, huh?
He fell off in the last race, but he won the one before.
That's a job.
The round before in Malaysia, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
He's had a few podiums this year, so I think he'll be quite strong going into
next
year.
Definite competitor.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of guys, you know. Thing is, when you're fighting for point two, like, if someone's having a bad weekend, they're in eighth, and then if they're having a good weekend, they might be winning, you know? So it's...
There's not much separating the top 10 riders.
Yeah. It's so tight.
Tell me, so we were chatting about this a couple of days ago. So a team Binder, which I know my wife actually asked you about as well. So you and Darren teaming up at some point, where do you see that happening? If it happens, where does it happen? MotoGP?
I hope the MotoGP, because if I stay in Moto2 for another year, then I've done something wrong next year.
So that means what? Next year, I mean 2020, you're hoping to go in a MotoGP?
I hope so. I mean, everything I do is to try and win the Moto2 World Championship next year. And if I can do that, you know, then obviously I want to be in MotoGP.
Fantastic, yeah.
So hopefully Darren could do the same in Moto3, and maybe I'll check him in GP one day.
How cool would that be, though?
That'd be pretty
sick. Imagine an all-South African team in MotoGP. Yeah, fantastic. No,
absolutely.
That's the dream for us.
Yes, it is.
We're going to make that happen.
Yeah,
that'd be
amazing.
So let's just talk a little bit about lifestyle in MotoGP or in Moto2 and all that type of thing. Just for the record, Brad and I, we had a night after the Cape Town Sevens in 2016, which was one of the most memorable nights, if only we could both remember it.
But I've seen photographs on your phone. You were just showing me some.
I like to call it the Bender with Binder.
Yeah.
So do you have time to let loose? I mean, what are the MotoGP parties like at the end of a race?
You know, like, basically during my season, I don't do much. Literally, I focus on training. I train every day. I ride as much as I can. I rest. I eat properly. I do everything perfectly. And then when I come home, South Africa in December, I'm the polar opposite. It's like, now's my... I like to call it drinking season, but it's really not professional.
You and I, we dovetail. So I do it the whole year.
Yeah.
And then I do it again at the end of the year, and you just do it at the end of the year.
So it's basically when it's your birthday and it's not your birthday.
Yes.
You celebrate.
That's pretty much it.
Okay. just to clarify.
And mostly at night, but sometimes during the day.
Okay.
So that's... At least not in the morning, because then you've got a problem.
No, but if you don't start in the morning, you can't drink all day.
Okay.
So, Brad, you said you're riding every day. Does that mean... Okay, so we know you have practice on Friday, qualifying Saturday, the race on Sunday. Monday to Thursday, I know the team's moving between sometimes continents, or if it's in Europe, you're moving between tracks. Do you get time to... I mean, do you guys arrive at the track early? Are you practicing early? Or you... I don't know. Where are you riding? Like on those off days, or are those off days just for training? And
basically, my week compared to team's week is completely different.
Okay, cool.
I rock up at the track on Thursday morning, set up my things, go through data, get everything ready, and then on Sunday, basically... then on Friday morning, we get ready and go.
Okay. Whereas, so you arrive, team's basically waiting for you. There's a bike. Here we go,
Yeah,
Brad.
Literally. That's it. And on the race on Sunday, I come back, hopefully after a podium.
Okay.
Yeah, hopefully. Normally, it's always a good race if it is. Literally get going to my truck, take my kit off, get dressed, grab my suitcase, and try to get out of there before the end of the MotoGP.
So it's a proper rockstar life, eh?
Like,
arrive, everything's done for you.
Yeah.
Leave, and you guys clean up. Cheers, I'm out of here.
Literally, it's honestly like it took me so long to get used to it.
Okay.
Because I'm not that kind of person.
Yeah.
I really don't dig it at all.
You like to get involved, obviously, try and help out.
You know, the thing is, it's. There's so many people in our team, and every person has their job.
Yeah.
And basically, like, I go to my guys, and I'm like, guys, like, can I help you with that? You know, they're like, listen, bud, just sit down and breathe. Like,
I like that.
It's
brilliant.
It's crazy.
But obviously, it like got to that stage. So, I mean, when you start out in Moto 3, like you said, you're trying to help out. They have to tell you, listen. And as you get more successful, I suppose they start to respect you as the rider more. And tell you, listen, hey, but we need you to like sit down and chill out. We got this, you know, which is cool.
I mean, it changes, honestly. Like if you think about maybe where I started in 2013, it's like I'm in a different world now. It's not it's not even the same. I can't even explain it. It's another world. Literally.
Yeah, but that's brilliant.
It's
you've done that.
How
that's
things
you.
Have changed.
That's your riding, you know.
But it's such a draw, honestly. I love it. I couldn't trade it for anything in the world. So.
We're living vicariously through you, man. Yeah, it's our dream as well.
And just like, I mean, talking about fitness and staying fit, what do you do? I mean, are you into like jogging, mountain biking? I mean, there's obviously like a certain amount of gymming that goes into it as well.
Yeah, my normal day during a season is I wake up every morning, go cycling.
Mm-hmm.
If the weather's not good, I'll go running. Mm. But I prefer cycling normally. I don't do anything too crazy, normally a couple of hours. You know, not really anything too serious on the bicycle. And then, go to the gym in the afternoons and try to rest, chill as much as I can. You know, how it works is my, say, mid-December until, let's say, March is where I really get my fitness from. This is where I work as hard as possible, train myself into a coma basically. And then from then on, it's just trying to stay fit and not burn yourself out in between the races.
Yeah, sure.
You know, you're so busy with all the traveling, we have a lot of like media events to go to, you know. A lot of people look at it and they say, oh, it's 18 races every second weekend. But actually, right in between, it's quite often we're going to events in different countries. So like
for your sponsors and that kind of thing.
You add a lot of miles up that are really not just actually for racing. So
okay.
It's you're so busy that it's important to just try and keep your fitness, maintain your fitness, and try not burn yourself out.
Cool, man.
And do you still ride motorbikes for fun? Like on a Sunday, if you've got like a Sunday off, do you ever get on a bike and say like, I'm going to go out for a ride? Or has it become so professional that now... If you've got spare time, you're like, I want to do something else.
Yeah, I believe in life, everything has to be in a balance.
Mm.
Honestly, like, you can go ride it, you're going to kill it for yourself.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
As enjoyable as it is, it's still your job in a way.
Yeah.
But, like, there's not one day in a week that if someone said, hey, should we go ride? I'd be like, nah. I'd go ride every single time.
So what bike do you have? What bikes do you have? Do you have bikes here in South Africa?
When I'm home here, I ride, I've got a KTM motocross bike.
Oh, cool,
I've got a supermoto. I've got a trials bike. I'm actually doing a trials event next next, well, this coming Sunday.
Oh, awesome.
So I better go practice because I haven't ridden the thing in about 2 years. So,
oh, lekker, that's fun. Eh?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
It's a different skill. It's very different. Eh?
Yeah, it's lekker. Honestly, like when I come riding here, I love to go riding with my mates and actually, sometimes it's nice to not just be on the clock the whole time, have your set schedule. Like you can just go out and you can do a 30-minute moto and have a draw, you know? Like,
and if you could choose one bike to keep in your garage, only one, what would it be?
One bike? Yes, yeah. I don't know. Honestly, I'm not much of a bike guy at all.
Yeah.
Like,
so let's talk about cars.
Yeah, I prefer cars.
We're a car show.
One car, one garage, what would it be?
Yes, but that's hard.
Come on, Brad.
Off with five. Could you name five that you off the cuff that you're lusting?
What's the dream garage?
Yes, but you know I'm trying to collect as much as I can without being stupid. But
No. Remove the stupid part. Yeah. Be stupid.
Yeah, be stupid. Buy anything you want.
Sensibility and car collecting don't go well together.
I've always for some reason when I was younger, I always wanted a GTR. So now I've got my Nissan GTR.
Lovely.
I got a Mustang.
An old Mustang, a new one.
Cool, yeah. I would love an old one though. If I find one, I'll definitely try
to get it. Tom has one. He can loan it to you.
Yeah.
A racing one.
Yeah, that's it. So that's the plan. I just got a Chevy old 1958 Apache truck.
Brilliant. Oh, that's a classic. That's cool. A real classic,
I don't know. I really want to find a Countach. I want a Lamborghini Countach.
Ah, you're speaking Mark's language.
I happen to know of one and I think you should do it.
Yeah, I'd love to. Like I enjoy cars. My dad's a car collector, so since I was a kid, I've always had... It's always been cars coming in and out.
Well, maybe we're not can't arrange a Countach, but maybe we need to meet up and you need to drive the Diablo. So
sounds like a draw. I'll be there.
You just want to recreate the Wolf of Wall Street scene in the Countach, I know.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do that a third time.
No, brilliant. That sounds like a cool collection. That's lekker. And you're on your way, man.
Yeah. Awesome. I've got one more technical question about your career. Just for the listeners out there, you know, it's always glamorous talking about being a professional sportsman and leading the life, but life on the road is hard. And in the end, you know, using the tennis analogy, they say that the fifth major is the qualifying tournament. It's the guys trying to get up into the next level, and you're in MotoGP, but in Moto2, and you're looking to get into MotoGP. At what point does the career start becoming financially, like that you start sorting yourself for the rest of your life, that
you stop paying
or having to get personal sponsors to try and get you to that level? At what point does it start really becoming that you start reaping the rewards of your phenomenal talent?
It really, really depends. I mean, there's a lot of different situations out there. I, for one, was really fortunate because, unfortunately, being South African, the only way I could ever get into MotoGP was my dad had to buy me a ride the first year. But I was fortunate enough that basically my dad sat me down and said, listen, this is how it's going to work. We can pay for 1 year and you need to make it on your own after that. If we can't find a ride at the end of the year, you know,
you're on your own. Yeah.
That's it. It's cool. You come home, you work for me kind of thing.
Cool.
And I was lucky enough. I did the year in 2012, 2013. I got a free ride.
Lekker.
And from then on, I've basically earned a salary to race every year, which is great. But I mean, Moto3 and Moto2 is nothing serious. It's only once you get into the big time in MotoGP where you can actually, something amazing.
I think that has to change because I must be honest, I've been a MotoGP fan all my life. And the last couple of years, Moto2 has just been such a sweet spot. I think in terms of viewership, you guys are where the real racing is happening now. If you're a racing enthusiast and you like that, you know, you like to see five guys contending for the win on the last lap. Moto2 is where it's happening.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're going to have to be...
Yeah, unfortunately, we're out of time.
But just to say that, just remember that when you're racing, you have a few idiots sitting here in South Africa screaming at the TV.
That's
amazing.
And we're rooting for you, and we can't wait for you to be in MotoGP.
Yeah, thanks, it's going to happen.
I can't wait either. You guys need to come watch.
Absolutely.
We will.
Absolutely.
All right, cool.
Cool, thanks, Brad. Thanks a lot for your time, and good luck for 2019.
Perfect. Thanks for having me on the show, guys.
A real pleasure. Man. Cheers.
Ciao.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Car Argumentative, and that was some very interesting insight from the one and only Brad Binder. It was quite a thing to interview him. Guys, we're moving along. We're talking about power, and I've got this thing that people are blinded by power figures, and they're blinded by 0 to 100, you know, times and quarter mile times, and I think that gets in the way of people buying cars. They look for these things instead of actually going out and driving a car. And it may not have as much power, but it may be a lot of fun. Like the 86 that Mark and I were driving around the other night. Like, very underpowered in a straight line. A mom in her diesel-powered cash car will probably outdrag you. But through corners, such a fun car. It really makes you want to go out and drive and take the long way home.
Yeah, true story. You know, I think, so a lot of it's actually about power to weight.
Mm.
People don't remember that. So you can have a car with lots and lots of power, but it can also weigh a lot, and that doesn't help anyone.
But I guess in this day and age, most cars are pretty heavy. I mean, you're going to struggle to get something under, I mean, besides the best car in the world.
The Alpha 4C.
Alpha 4C, we haven't mentioned
it. But that's perfect. Yeah. That's a perfect example.
Talk a little bit about that.
Because there you have a 1750cc engine, turbocharged. The car weighs under a ton.
Well, it's 800 and what? 865 or something?
Whatever. Like. Yeah, something like that.
It weighs 895.
Depends which Alpha representative you're speaking to. Yeah. And it outperforms cars that are 3-4 times its price with 3-4 times its horsepower.
Yeah.
Kilowatts power.
Kilowatts.
Yeah, we're in South Africa.
We live in South Africa.
I'd like to
weigh in here.
I'd like to weigh in for a minute.
Okay, please do.
I just want to put the brakes on here.
Yeah.
We've had a complaint.
We have.
And that complaint is, why do we always talk in horsepower? So if we're going to talk about power, let's just lay down some ground rules for a minute. What's the difference between brake horsepower and kilowatts? So we always talk about horsepower. And
well, you guys do.
Well, we do. I know.
Confuses me as well.
The reason that we do that is that all the sort of a lot of the highly respected motoring literature and a lot of stuff that we end up reading online and in the print is US or
Evo,
UK.
Evo. Nadav's getting all, his Evo on.
Yeah. And it's all in brake horsepower. And so we get used to the figures quoted about these cars, and so we quote them amongst ourselves. But in the end, that's the incorrect unit for South Africa. We should be talking in kilowatts. Kilowatts and brake horsepower are two different ways of measuring power.
Yeah. And the conversion is basically
just gone to Google.
About 0.75. So
that's right.
You take, so if it's 100 horsepower, it's about 75 kilowatts.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you, Mike.
Is it? Okay.
So that's one thing. And then the other thing is, yes, I agree, the power to weight ratio is actually what's the most important thing in a car. And the power to weight ratio is never really quoted. But in the end, that's what's going to tell you whether that car is quick or not.
Absolutely. I've got a question, maybe a comment, just to set some context here, because, you know, when I think some of the listeners, when we start talking about cars without power, the thought is, fine, you're going to buy a car that doesn't have power, but then you're going to use it for something different. So you're not going to take it on a spirited drive. If it hasn't got any power, you're going to use it for cruising, going up and down the coast, going slowly up and down, maybe a little bit of posing and all kinds of things like that. The question that I'd like to ask you guys is what your thoughts are, and is that if you've got a car that's got little power, can you still have a lot of fun in it? And I mean, I think we know the answer, but I'd like to just unpack that a little bit as to why we can and why power, the absolute power, isn't that important.
You see, I mean, I think on everyday roads, if you've got a car with like 300 kilowatts, you're never actually going to use all that power because you just can't, because you don't have enough space. The roads aren't big enough. There's too much traffic. There's too much other stuff to get in the way.
And I think we've said this before, Thomas. Mm-hmm. You might not. We will.
No, you can't. It's just ridiculous. I mean, I drive, you know, in the course of a year, maybe 4 or 5 supercars. And if anything, they just frustrate me because you can't actually use these cars to their full, to their, you know, sort of full
potential.
That's the word I'm looking for. And it's just, you know, sometimes I think this thing is pointless. Why do I have this car? And then you get into something like an MX-5 RF or an 86, which are cars that kind of get slated because they don't have power, they're hairdressers cars, they're not, you know, and I actually find myself having more fun in them. I just had the 86 on test. And for the first time in a very long time, I found myself taking the long way home at night because, like, you know, here I am in this car. It's manageable. I can get it out and control it. And, you know, I'm not going to go into a tree or into a shop front and around the green side.
Shop front.
I'm not going to end up in Paco's carpet. Yeah, you know what I mean? And it's just one of those cars which is fun and you can really enjoy it around corners.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's you can really get stuck into it.
Agreed.
Well, I think on that point, Mike was asking, well, what is it about cars that, is it about absolute power or is it about enjoying yourself? And maybe my answer to that is maybe it's about the challenge. So, in other words, driving a fast car fast is easy.
Correct.
It's easy to get fast in a fast car.
Yeah.
It's not so easy to get fast in a slow car. And so the challenge of driving a slow car fast,
yeah,
is maybe what eggs us on, is what makes you enjoy the GT86.
Yeah, because
not full of power, in which case deriving the maximum enjoyment out of it is a challenge.
It makes you go faster in areas where you wouldn't bother going faster in more powerful cars, like corners. It encourages you to brake later, go in faster, increase the corner speed. It's just more fun. I don't know. It drives you to be a more interactive.
So on that, like we have the fortune of driving rental cars from time to time, all of us.
Mm.
And that's one of the things we discuss the most, is how surprised we are at how fun rental cars are. And they're always these tiny engined, light, nippy little cars, and we end up getting out of our big V8s and having so much fun in these little, sometimes three-cylinder.
Yeah, like a Volkswagen app.
Yeah.
Great fun.
And they're so much fun.
Excellent. Sounds great.
Sounds great. You can throw them around corners.
You can drive it at 12 tenths all the time.
12 tenths.
And it's
yeah, so they're
it's
great.
A jewel.
So here we are.
Slow car fast is very fun.
So I've got two cars in my collection that sort of bookend the power, and that it's quite interesting. So the fastest I've got is the Diablo, which is, well, it's not the fastest, but it's the most powerful. It's got just around 500 horsepower, which is, what do you call it, 375 kilowatts. It's so quite heavy. It's quite heavy. Mm. But it's the most absurd illustration of how silly the manufacturers were with power. So when they launched it, they wanted to make it one of the most rapidly accelerating cars in the world and have the highest top speed. So the gearing is
and that's all they care about.
Absurd. Absolutely, absolutely. Mm. I mean, look, the engine is exceptionally torquey with being a V12, so it is actually very drivable in any gear. But it goes 96 k's an hour in first gear, which is exactly 60 miles an hour, which is the quoted, our 0-100 is 0-60 miles an hour in Europe.
And
the reason they did that was so that you could go under 4 seconds because you wouldn't need a gear change.
So put that in perspective. Most cars that people drive every day would only reach 100 kilometers an hour in third gear, and you're getting there in first.
In first. Now, then on top of that, it's a 5-speeder and it's geared for about 330 k's an hour in top. So, as I say, it's quite drivable because it is very torquey. But if you hear me rev 3 gears around town, it's not safe. It's just simply not safe. And, you know, even going into second gear and giving it some horns. And I think that for me, that's a bit of a problem. So I have to go and find places, big places, to go and be able to rev that car.
Mm.
Now, on the other side, I've got a 1970 911E, which weighs just on 1,000 kilos. And it's got 165 horsepower, which is like 120 kilowatts. That car is my favorite because I can do something in that car that I can't do in almost anything else. I can rev to third gear, and I'm still not going that fast, but it's evocative.
Mm.
And as Nadav said, I've got to think about how I'm getting to that speed, and it's a challenge. And I can tell you that for me, it's just far more rewarding than being in the Diablo.
Well, it's using everything the car has to offer, whereas in the Diablo, you're not always able to make use of what it could offer you. In the 911E, because it's earlier, not powerful, you're able to use the entire maximum that the car can give you. And I think that's very rewarding, as you say.
It is. And now they've gone, manufacturers, and they've gone and made even more power and made it even more easily accessible through automatic gearboxes and
traction control.
You feel cocooned and you feel safe. And all you do is plant your right foot and the car does the rest. So that takes away from the driving experience. So the stuff we love is getting involved, going through the gears, revving the engine out, keeping momentum around corners.
Which is why some of the, the most enjoyable cars that I've ever had haven't been the fastest or the most powerful. You know, they've just been simple cars like 86s, MX-5s, Fiat Panda, 100 HP. I mean, that thing has got like what?
100 horsepower.
100 horsepower. There you go. Yeah, 100 horsepower.
Says it on the tin.
Yeah, exactly. And that was just such a joy because you were just constantly revving and wanted to rev.
Yeah.
And you just had fun in it. And actually,
So I've got another car which I love to drive, and it's a 1968 1300 Alfa Spider.
Yeah.
I think it's got 60 kilowatts, if that. I mean, double-decker buses overtake me on uphills. But it is such a ride to drive. Yeah. It's brilliant. It's great. Yeah, I love it. It's fantastic. You can drift it.
At my house on Sunday, I had a little makeshift Cars and Coffee, and a friend of mine came with a Dodge Demon.
Oh, my. Yeah, that thing was amazing.
A Dodge Demon.
What color is it?
The Challenger, it's gray. He actually has two of them, and that's the one that comes factory from with 800 horsepower. And I was sitting there speaking to someone, and I said, do you realize this thing that we're standing next to? And he was revving it, and it's got this beautiful supercharger whine and a whole lot of details where, like, it comes with a crate with a skinny front tire in case you want to take it to the drag strip and you can really have fun with it. But it's got 800 horsepower, which is like 600 kilowatts. And the comment that I made to him was, this thing's got about the same power as a current Formula One car.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I mean, the thing's sitting in my drive.
It sounded amazing, though.
Yeah, it does. It sounds amazing. It's got the presence and it's got
it all translates petrol into sound, and we love that.
Yeah,
but at the same time, screeching and plumes of smoke.
Yeah. At the same time, it's completely useless. I don't know. To me, bigger just isn't always better.
No, look, there is an argument for that, but sometimes we are all about power because it's fun.
Nadav, to wrap it up. Final thoughts?
Well, final thoughts is I think that what we entered into, I would say, I don't know, 10 years ago is an arms race where the customer, the buyer, understands power in terms of the headline figure. And perhaps people don't necessarily appreciate that more power is not necessarily better. We've been discussing how less power makes a car potentially more fun, where you can extract more out of it. And what's happened is, the buyer is requesting more power. And if one manufacturer gives it, the next one needs to compete as well. And what's happened is that there's been an arms race and power has gradually been increasing. The other thing that's been increasing is, as we alluded to, is the fact that we can control that power better. You need less experience, less expertise, less skill behind the wheel to control as much power as you would have in the 1980s, for argument's sake. 400 horsepower is found in a hot hatch these days. It's four-wheel drive, it's traction control, it's ABS, and everything is regulated and makes that power much more accessible to everybody. Either that's good or bad, I suppose that's a matter of opinion.
Well, are we wrapping up now?
We're wrapping up, so if, final thoughts.
Final thoughts is actually, I do, because driving that 86, although I have to put it out there, I do feel like it was maybe slightly underpowered. I do like their approach to it because they took a narrower tire as well. So narrower tire, the most incredible chassis, and this slightly underpowered motor, just is so much fun.
Exactly.
So maybe that's a message to other manufacturers.
Yeah. And to people out there, don't let the sexy silken scarf of power blindfold you from the true fun cars that are out there.
Wow.
Very nice.
Nice.
And buy an Alfa 4C.
Or not. We're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, we are going to talk about a tour. Guys, welcome back to Cargumentative. In this segment, we're going to be chatting about a tour that Mark and Nadav went on a couple of months ago, and it's something that Mike has been nagging about week after week. What about the Aston Martin factory tour? So this is your big chance to ask questions, and
So let me tell you about it first,
yeah,
and then you can ask questions.
Cool.
If I don't tell you everything I know.
Yeah.
So we were fortunate enough to go and attend the Goodwood Revival earlier this year, September, early September. And seeing as though we were in the UK, we thought let's tick a few other boxes. And one of the ones we wanted to tick was to go and do a tour of the Aston Martin factory, which is in Gaydon, like central United Kingdom. Lovely part of the woods. Very nice. Anyway, they rolled out the red carpet for us.
First of all, how did you arrange this? Did you have to do something before you
Yeah, so you have to go to your local Aston Martin dealership and they arrange it for you. Which is
Do you have to own an Aston Martin or be James Bond?
They say that you do. They say you do. So very fortunate enough to be on that list. And yeah, we got this amazing tour. We were assigned this tour guide who was a very knowledgeable, lovely lady. We arrived to snacks and tea and coffee and
really,
yeah, we were taken into the.
It's like being a motoring journalist,
almost. You know, so we like
was there
baby
a car
steps
on the water when you
there
got
was
there.
A car on the water, and they have other cars dotted in other places along the grounds, which is beautiful.
Did you meet Peter Goff?
Well, I'm sure we did. I mean, is he the guy with the spanners?
He's the guy that spanned your car. Apparently.
Yeah, apparently
he signed it off.
Yeah, I saw him. Yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
So it was very cool. Then we went on a tour of the factory. Firstly, they showed us – was it first that they showed us the history of Aston or was it after the tour? So first they took us and they showed us – they got a selection of old cars there, which is very interesting, some very valuable stuff, some James Bondy stuff. And then we got to walk around the factory where they assemble the cars, where they – for me, some of the most fascinating parts was – building the leather seats.
You know? Well, that's what I was going to ask you.
Yeah.
Like, have they got their own bespoke
so they've got
guy
this,
with leather and
they do.
A man in an apron.
No, like ladies.
Ladies.
And there's quite a few of them. There are rows of ladies and sewing machines, all hand-stitched. It's lovely.
Yeah.
But they've got this awesome machine where they lay leather. So not everyone has seen. A few people have seen how they take a leather hide and they mark out the imperfections and then they laser cut to get the best use out of that hide. But another section was where they perforate the hide. So they make little holes in the hide, which was very cool.
And that's all done by hand?
No, that's done by machine.
Oh.
And then they assemble all those pieces together. Yeah, and then you got – they had two production lines. So they got the Vantage production line and the new DB11 production line.
Did you meet the man who makes those crystal key fobs? Was he there like tapping away on this big hunk of like imported
I would more want to meet the guy who cut the keys of the Ford Fiestas like on yours and mine.
Those days are gone.
And programmed the Volvo key fob.
So there's still some technology sharing in Aston Martin. They don't hide the fact that they technology share with Mercedes-Benz these days. But I must say that that was a special day. I think there was a little bit of a heightened atmosphere at the factory that day. The first customers were coming in to spec their Valkyries.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and so there were some big shots flying around there specking their 1.3 million euro hypercars.
Well, it's strange that you didn't bump into Mike then.
Mike, were you busy that day?
I think he was there the day after.
Because you saw Jay Leno, so it could have been.
we think that Mike is a budding up and coming Jay Leno. He's
a young Jay Leno.
He's wearing denim
more definition.
As we speak.
Stop.
But back to Aston Martin. So it was quite a special day. Like I say, quite a nice atmosphere there that day, I think specifically. And what was interesting to me was how much of the factory floor space was devoted to the bespoke stuff. So a relatively small amount was devoted to the actual production line, I thought.
Yeah, you're right.
Whereas the paint facilities and the bespoke leather work and dashboard detail and all of that actually took out a lot of room. And I think that they've realized that it's the bespoke stuff that sells these cars.
Well, that's the fascinating part, is to watch the painting and to watch them mixing the paint and doing the stitching and all those final touches that help make an Aston become an Aston. You know what I mean?
So actually, they were building a new kind of light room. So they drive the car, once it's finished paint and assembly, they drive it under this array of lights where they go and inspect the paintwork. And I mean, you could light up a country with the amount of light shining onto the car from there.
I would love to do that job. That must be the best job, because you've got to be like completely OCD and you've just got carte blanche to be as anal as possible and say, ah, no, look at this.
Yeah, send it back.
Send it back. It's not, that's not going
to happen. What is the car you saw that was being prepped for delivery?
So I'm leaving that to my highlights, because I want to ask you what the highlights of your day. We have to wrap this up.
I just want to ask quickly. So these cars are all handmade. So you and I both have a V8 Vantage, and even though ours are basically the appliances of the Aston range, they're
still lovely.
They're hand assembled.
Everything
that's something that just
there's not a single robot in sight in that factory. Everything is, they have them on jigs that obviously move up and down to give better access and roll them over so that people can work on them. But it's still, everything is hand applied with drills and screwdrivers and spanners, and yeah, it's brilliant. It's really, you know that if your car has come out of that production line, it's been done properly.
So what was the highlight of your day?
To wrap up, what stood out for you most?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, the whole thing was a great experience. I know what Nadav's was. But yeah, for me, I didn't really have a highlight. I really liked all of it.
Is Aston Martin Motorsport there?
No, that's done at ProDrive down the road. So they have an association with ProDrive, and the lady who gave us our tour is actually very involved with ProDrive. She was super knowledgeable. Actually, she was my highlight. She was fantastic.
Excellent.
She blew our minds with her knowledge, and she knew. I mean, you could ask her any question about the history of Aston, and she'd give you the answer. She was fantastic.
Was her name Moneypenny?
It was, actually.
So for me, just out of the corner of my eye, on the far side of the factory, I spotted something. It was being prepped, final prep, and it was the new Vanquish Zagato shooting brake.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so that's what's called a unicorn. Okay, those cars are going from the factory into collections, and they will not be seen ever again. I think that they were in single figures production,
yeah,
if I'm not mistaken, or at most double digits, and those things will not be seen again until they come out onto the lawn at Pebble Beach in 20, 30 years' time. So to see one in the flesh before it's even
been, it was brilliant.
Put out on the road, what a thing. Goosebumps.
That is quite a thing. Quite a thing indeed.
I'm looking at one now, and I'm, Tim Henman, eh?
Yeah. Well, guys, that sounds like one for the bucket list. I mean, you guys have done a lot of bucket list stuff this year. Yeah. Quite envious. That's all we really have time for in today's show. So thanks again for joining me in the studio. I'm Thomas Faulkner, and catch us next week for another episode of Cogumentative.